At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production, available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hello.
Another weekend coming to an end, my friend.
Yes, it is.
Now, this guest I'm excited to chat with. We did a show kind of in the similar vein on our True Crime Tuesday program and found some interesting aspects about what we're going to cover today. But I'm really excited to talk with our guest because I think he's got a unique and different perspective on this. And this is something that I find fascinating. The book that we're talking about is called Shadows in the Session, The Presence of the Anomalous in Psychotherapy. By examining research into the supernatural conducted by the early founders of psychotherapy, along with first-person accounts from therapists who have experienced strange events in their therapy sessions, this book provides readers with a peek at a hidden area of psychotherapy that is rarely discussed. The paranormal is not something that many would connect to the field of psychotherapy, but whether one believes in the phenomena or not, this book enlightens the reader that such occurrences continue to be experienced by both clients and their therapists. Joining us on the show is Dr. Paul Leslie. Dr. Leslie, thank you so much for being here with us.
Well, it's an honor to be with you guys.
This is fascinating to me. Again, this is something that a lot of people would think, you know, a bunch of mumbo jumbo and a bunch of goofy guys on weekend radio talking about these topics, but nobody would really take it seriously, especially when it comes to psychotherapy. When did this first start to, become recognized in the field as something more than just the blatherings of psychopaths?
Well, it's an interesting question because I don't think it's really been recognized. I think it's happening, granted, not happening all the time. And I agree that some of these instances are rare, but these kind of strange phenomena do happen. But because psychotherapy works very hard to be seen as a legitimate science in a way that I think it's minimized and oftentimes just kind of ignored, but which is really interesting because it's been that way since the beginning of psychotherapy in the times of Freud and Carl Jung and others. But yet this is something that even Freud had issues with, and even privately was very intrigued and investigated and conducted his own kind of research into some paranormal things that he kept hidden and his biographers kept hidden for many years. And so this is something that's been plaguing us from the beginning.
Our guest today, Dr. Paul Leslie, is an author, educator, and psychotherapist in Aiken, South Carolina, and he specializes in creative resource-directed approaches to working with individuals and families, which is why I knew he would be a great guest to discuss this. His book focuses on the areas of psychotherapy, healing, shamanism, and personal development. Paul is presently the coordinator of the Behavioral Sciences Program at Aiken Technical College. We have a link up to his website as well. How do they respond when you're in an institution, a university like this? I've got to guess there's got to be a little pushback when you start delving into the realm of the paranormal.
I haven't told them yet.
Oh, well, should we make that call together? Yeah, that would be an interesting part of our show.
Yeah, I may need your guidance and support on that one. But no, most of my, as you said, most of my work has been in the realm of psychotherapy and writing, I think, some pretty solid books on how to perform therapy. So this is one of the a big departure for me. So I haven't really. Not that I'm hiding it, but I haven't said too much. But again, I think it's an interesting phenomena in that collectively the opinions are one way. And then when you get people out of the collective and talk to them individually, you get a different story. And I've gotten – when I was doing research in this and I was getting a lot of first-person accounts from – therapist around the country, around the world, who would contact me. Most all, not all, but most all were like, just don't use my real name. Change, you know, things so I can have some confidentiality. So I think a lot of these things happen. But as I said earlier, if we're trying to show ourselves as a field that has some grounding in empiricism, which we do, when you start talking about, you know, these odd things can happen in a therapy session sometimes, I think there's fears of losing credibility in the eyes of the public or maybe within the field itself. So it was with, I got to be honest, it's with some trepidation that I even kind of wrote the book. But I felt it was an important thing to write about, because also if we shine a light that strange things can sometimes happen in a therapy session, maybe we can also kind of depathologize things that clients come in that are strange or unexplained, that we don't automatically have to jump to a psychological disorder, and kind of humanize that. Because I mean, this is something that at least these experiences, whether we believe that they're the, you know, esoteric or parapsychological, whatever the etiology, these things have been going on since the beginning of time.
Well, here's a question for you then. If there are so many therapists worldwide that are encountering this, this is no longer a closeted subject then, doctor. This is something that is a new finding in your field. Isn't it a little frightening to realize that as breakthroughs are happening, instead of embracing them and moving forward and enriching the human experience, it's being hidden? I mean, and please, I'm not trying to attack the psychotherapy field, but it kind of makes me feel uncomfortable knowing that psychotherapists are seeing this change and don't want to discuss it. Mm-hmm. I thought that the whole idea is to evolution, you know, of this, and to make things better for everyone, period, you know, for the therapists and the experiencers. It can't be just summarily dismissed if there are hundreds or possibly thousands of psychotherapists encountering the same thing.
Well, you know, denial is one of the defense mechanisms. You know, it's if we don't understand something, it's we oftentimes deny it. And if we feel our reputation, our professional or personal reputation, is on the line, you know, that's we proceed cautiously. You know, I had a colleague who told me, it's hard enough with the stigma about seeking help in general, because, you know, most people who need access to quality psychotherapy don't seek it because of a lot of stigma of you know, who's being seen as weak or crazy or all of that. And if we already have that stigma in place for the field to overcome, when you start saying that sometimes therapists and clients can pick up on each other's thoughts, sometimes strange things move in a session, or they, people get quick visions and things like that. There's that fear that those people who might have been on the fence, who could probably benefit from therapy, won't come. Because again, most therapists never have this happen, but the ones that do, it's very real. And what I found, it's very frightening, because, you know, our logical materialistic brain wants to, you know, have an easy explanation, and we don't like things that we can't easily explain.
So could I ask you this? And again, you can be as open with me and candid as you'd like, or if you want to pass the question altogether, I understand that. Do you believe that maybe the reason only a handful of psychotherapists have this is because they're truly empathetic? And I don't mean in the empathy way that everybody thinks, the metaphysical way, but because they haven't already become jaded to their job or just walk in through the steps, which we all do in our positions in life. We all end up getting to a point where we're just walking through it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just curious if you think that maybe the reason a lot of them don't have it is because of that exact situation.
Well, I think that may be some of it. The other thing that I've found, and again, this is more of a qualitative narrative thing I've been doing. I haven't put as much my interest was in getting the stories out rather than doing an intense research project. But what I found in most of the people that I spoke with, it's generally a longer term and more intense relational patterns they have with the client. It's generally going to come out if they have that deep empathy, that deep connection with a client. I remember one of the cases I wrote about, the gentleman who had something very bizarre happen where he swears he saw a dark figure come and go behind one of his clients. This is a guy who was going to be an engineer originally. He is so left brain, but yet he had been, as a clinical psychologist, been in a deep level of rapport for a long time with this particular client. So maybe it was that interaction, that merging of consciousness, if you will, that created that. So it might not be that if you see a client just a couple of times, you may not have that happen because of the speed of the work. But I'm beginning to see it's something like it's a, for lack of a better term, a melding of the minds that catches a lot of these people by surprise. I intentionally went out of my way that I did not use the stories of any therapist who claimed to be a psychic or medium or anything like that, because I wanted to hear from people who weren't expecting strange things to happen. And a lot of times we're just not believers. And some of them continue to not be believers, but at the same time, it's always in the back of their mind. What is really going on here?
All right. Now, talk to me about the beginnings of this for you. Did this happen to you, or was this something you were hearing about with other therapists?
Well, and this has been the hardest part, Dave, because it did happen to me, and I wrote a little bit about it. And it was I shelved this book for a little while because I was worried about kind of exposing myself, if you will. I don't know if I should say that, if I should say exposing myself psychologically.
Well, either way, yeah, I understand.
Yeah, either way is not
being reticent to expose yourself in any way.
Right, yeah. And but I finally got to the point that I talked to someone else and they had this similar kind of thing happen, and I needed to explore it. What had happened, just real briefly, is I'd had a long-term client who we had a very good working relationship, and I think there was a deep level of interpersonal rapport and connection. And she was dealing with a lot of personal issues, and she's also suffering from bipolar disorder, which can be a very debilitating mental health condition. And one particular day, she came to see me, and she was not having a good day. And she began talking to me about her father. And she only mentioned her father, I think, one time, because most of the time it wasn't really pertinent to our work. But her father died many years earlier. And she was expressing a deep level of regret that he couldn't see that she was making improvements. She'd been, you know, seeking medication, and that had helped, and the psychotherapy that we were doing was helping. And she just hoped that her father had lived to see her succeed and grow. Well, the only way I can describe this is as she's saying that, I mean, she's crying. It's, you know, tugging at my heartstrings, but we try to be somewhat supportive and empathic, but detached. And then all of a sudden, I just popped in my head to pull a technique from Gestalt therapy, which is a therapy created by Fritz Perls, in which if a person you needed to make peace with is no longer around, you can sometimes say, well, imagine they're sitting in this empty chair and there's a chair beside me. So I asked her, I said, if your father was sitting right here, right now beside me, what would you like to say to him? So I thought it was a good way she could get some of this grief out. The second I said that, Dave, and it still kind of gives me a little chills to talk about it publicly, but the only way I can explain this is it felt like I didn't see anything, but I felt like a presence in the chair beside me. And I don't even have words it was a feeling. So, of course, me being a left brain psychology guy, studies all the sensory sensation and perception, thought, okay, it's just kind of mind playing your tricks on you. And the next thing I know, I started to get this imagery in my head. I saw two things. I saw this little ice cream we call the push-up. I don't know if you're familiar with those. There's a kind of sherbet ice cream.
Oh, yeah, little orange, right?
Yeah.
Stick you push from the bottom. Oh, yeah, I love push-ups.
Yeah, I love them too much. Let's put it that way. I saw that, and then I saw a body of water like a lake, and it just popped in my mind so forcefully. And the next thing I knew, I said, I didn't realize I had said it. I said, what if your father's in the chair and he wanted to say something about ice cream push-ups? And I didn't even realize I'd said it. And she just broke down. And she just like, my dad, that was our thing. We would go to the, wait for it, lake, which is the body of water I saw. And he would always get me the push-ups when I was a little girl. And when I was a little girl, I'd pretend like I had lipstick, and he would laugh at me. And that was our thing. We always went on our, lake push-up trips. And at that point, I just started breaking down, crying. I had no idea why I was crying. And I found myself standing up. I don't know why. And then she stood up automatically, I guess. And then, I gave her a hug, which I don't usually do the huggy thing, And we just cried for a minute, and I think I said, well, maybe your dad wants you to know he's proud of you. And somehow we sat back down, and I got through the rest of the session, and thank God that has never happened again. I don't want anyone who's listening contacting me to connect. I'm not a medium. I'm not a psychic. I've never had this again. I am more than happy to never have that happen again. And to be quite fair, I haven't quite bought into the idea that there was any body in the room with me. That's kind of was so unsettling that it kind of sent me on this journey to see, am I the only one? And also to start learning more about things like this that happen, that maybe it's real quick to ridicule them, from a science perspective and dismiss them. But if, and I hate to say it like this, but if it can happen to me, it can happen to anybody. And so that's kind of set me on the journey.
This connectivity, a sign of being an empath, that's what most would say in hearing that. Do you look now at your life and realize that there have been other moments where you seem interconnected to those, to people around you, even ones that you may not know intimately?
It's in some ways it's hard to tell. Just being a therapist, connection, is our primary tool, and actually it's one of the main things that helps create change in therapy sessions. I haven't noticed that I'm any more intuitive than I was. Maybe I'm more open now to acting on my intuition. And, maybe I feel like I have a little more freedom to do that. So, I've been searching for reasons why that happened. That pushed me to start studying more about alternative research into consciousness. And is there, one of the things I discovered is there a grid of information that sometimes when two people are in a certain emotional state that one can pick up information out of this invisible grid and all these different ideas that maybe, whereas previously I viewed consciousness as pretty much it is strictly a physical thing that's created by the brain. And so I still don't know. I'm still open to different ideas. My left brain logic still is in charge here, but yet I'm more open to the idea that maybe consciousness is a little more flexible than we think. William James, who's one of the fathers or is the father of American psychology, viewed the brain is really acts as a reducing valve where there's all this information of all these different emotional, physical things that we maybe were not aware of, that its job is to keep out information that maybe we don't need or is not directly tied to our survival. But he viewed consciousness as existing in most everything. It's called he called it panpsychism. And after my experience, I guess maybe I'm warming to that. And then reading more about William James, who I've always been fascinated with, and finding out how much research he did into the paranormal and how a lot of his career was sabotaged because of his research into the parapsychological realm. It was kind of a word of caution for me.
I only asked when I was bringing up the point of being connected to the clients, because you do have to remain disconnected. And listen, I know some therapists who, you know, they go in and they're doodling on their pages and they're not connected because they know it's more about the client and than anything they can possibly offer. So that's why I wondered if it's somebody that's more in tune to this. Do you see maybe in any of this that the people that were relating these stories, it began earlier in their career, or was it things that began to happen later as they settled in more in their career as psychotherapists when they started to have these supernatural moments?
Right. For a lot of them, they'd been doing it for a little while. I think if my memory serves me, one or two maybe have just been doing it, the first couple of years. But most of them were more seasoned. And just going back to the point about the longer term relationship, maybe because they were more seasoned, they kind of could understand emotional boundaries better. So maybe hypothetically, they were able to kind of let their emotional guard down a little bit due to their experience. But that little bit might have created that connection, which led to other things, like I said, issues of telepathy and feelings of deceased and departed loved ones, or moments of synchronicity. So I don't want to say a definite fact, but generally most of the people I talk to, they've been doing it for a few years. Yeah.
All right. Before we go much further, folks, I got something interesting to talk to you about. And, you know, Tim and I try to bring you things that we like, that we believe in, we use. And this is something that has definitely changed in my household. Native, take care of your body. It's the only place you have to live. At Native, they create safe, simple, effective products that people use in the bathroom every day. They create products with trusted ingredients and trusted performance. Not convinced? Check out the over 8,000 five-star reviews from their customers. How's that sound? 8,000 five-star reviews, right? All of their products are amazing. They're formulated without aluminum, parabens, or talc. They're filled more with ingredients found in nature, such as coconut oil for antimicrobial help, shea butter, which is a great moisturizer and emollient. There's tapioca starch, which absorbs the wetness. And best of all, no animal testing. Can I hear an amen on that, my friends? I know you're just like Tim and I. You love our animals. Well, this company understands that, and they don't test on animals. Plus, did I mention that they have free shipping and returns? It works. Making the switch to a natural deodorant doesn't mean that you have to sacrifice an odor and wetness protection. Test it out and tell everybody that you know how much you love this, because that's what we're doing. Tim and I made the switch, and it's made a big difference. And listen, I'm a big guy. When I move, I'm sweaty, and I need something that's going to treat me right and is going to keep me smelling good. And I'm always cautious, especially with the advent of all of these new versions coming out. So it's been very hard for me to find the right connection, but Native delivers. They have over 8,000 five-star reviews. You can check them out on the Today Show, Elle Magazine, Pop Sugar, Refinery 29, just to mention a few. And less is more with Native. They have fewer, simpler ingredients, so you know everything that's in the deodorant. It's worth it. Native is aluminum-free, it's safe, and it's effective. It's got something for everyone as well. Native comes in a wide variety of enticing scents for men and women. Plus, they release new limited-edition seasonal scents throughout the year. We also offer an unscented formula and baking soda-free formula for those with more sensitivities. Right now, my favorite, I got to be honest with you, I don't know, Tim, you know, some guys like the smell of pine tar and mud, right?
Sure.
You read all these deodorant scents and it's things like, well, I'm an indoor kind of guy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I'm not, I don't want to smell like lumberjack, you know, and and pine trees. I want to smell like I live my life, Tim, and that happens to be coconut and vanilla.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, maybe Tim's more of a lavender and rose kind of guy. The other one I live by and my wife likes is the cucumber and mint. So there's a great variety of scents that really smell good. They feel good. They keep me dry. That's the best part for me. Plus, no risk to try it. They offer free returns and exchanges here in the good old United States of these here Americas, Tim.
Yep.
How about that? So you could try my favorite, the coconut and vanilla, or the cucumber and mint, or you could try Tim's favorite, the lavender and rose, because he likes to smell pretty.
I do like to smell pretty.
Really does.
Yeah.
So you could try those for yourself. I love this. We've got a really great deal for 20% off your first purchase. Visit nativedeodorant.com and then use the promo code darkness when you're checking out. That's 20% off your first purchase at nativedeodorant.com. Then use promo code darkness during your checkout. Go do it. Try it. And listen, if you love our show and shows like this, the best way to help us is by supporting the advertisers who support this show. So make sure that your next purchase is through nativedeodorant.com. And remember to use that code word darkness during checkout to save 20% off. Pluto TV is the leading free streaming television service. Tim and I have been talking about it ad nauseum for almost a year now. Why is that? Because we believe in Pluto TV. As a matter of fact, hallelujah, Tim, I've just moved from my rental house into my first home with Winnie. This is our first brand new old home together.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. You know what we did, though? We cut the cords, Tim. We got rid of cable. We got rid of satellite TV.
That's a big change.
Feel,
big change.
I feel like I'm a pioneer, Tim.
You should. Riding my
buck wagon over to the house to drop off the furniture and cutting off all strands with cable, but I'm glad I did it. And part of the reason I could do it is because I've kept my streaming service. I need my internet, Tim, because if I can't cruise the internet, life is not worth living.
True.
That's sad to say, but it's partly true. But now I've got Pluto TV. Why? Because it is the leading free streaming television service. You can watch over 100 TV channels and thousands of movies on demand, all for free. Tim, they have a James Bond channel.
I know.
Oh, yeah. I'm a huge James Bond fan. But they have something for everyone. And best, no credit card is needed. You don't have to sign up either. Pluto TV is easy. It's a completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and your hit movies. What are you waiting for? Never pay for TV again. And when you cut those bonds and you've got that extra money, it's a great time to go subscribe to True Crime Tuesday. I'm just saying. So Pluto TV is making your life easier, and it makes subscribing to our show even more easy to get involved in. So go check it out. Download Pluto TV for free on all of your favorite devices today, and then go subscribe to your pals Dave and Tim over at True Crime Tuesday. You'll find all that information at darknessradio.com. But if you want the best TV and movies free streaming, make sure that you get Pluto TV on your phone, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, smart TVs, PlayStations, hell, anywhere that you stream, Pluto TV is available for you. All right, let's dive back into this. I'm so fascinated and love having you on the show with us today, Dr. Paul Leslie, our guest. Shadows in the Session, the Presence of the Anomalous in Psychotherapy. Can you give us a brief description? What exactly is psychotherapy?
Yeah, psychotherapy, I think the easiest way to define it is a interaction between two or more people, usually through the realm of talking, conversation, as a method to help alleviate mental and emotional suffering. So, I mean, you could take that in many different directions. What most people think of is just two people or more having, like I say, a conversation. There's still the imagery left over from years and years ago, the time of Freud, of someone lying on the couch and, you know, the the therapist with the German accent asking rather invasive questions about the sex life and all of that. But if you were to walk by an open door and just see psychotherapy happening, it's usually people just sitting and talking.
And getting through this, helping people kind of come to terms with the things that are bothering them, when you're starting to see the strange anomalous phenomena take place around them, are there key triggers that you seem now that you're starting to notice that when somebody has XYZ happening in their life, you start to realize, oh, there's something supernatural behind this?
Mm-hmm. Well, you see, that's really a difficult thing to know for sure. And that's where I think it's important for psychotherapist, psychiatrist, everyone to kind of, and we're supposed to be putting our biases to the side, but oftentimes because of our training, it's real easy for us to quickly, something that's strange or out of the ordinary, particularly if a client is bringing that to us, that we test to make sure it's not magical thinking. They're having some kind of psychopathology as auditory or visual hallucinations and things like that. But if one really dives into the research, you find that a lot of times a large chunk of the population reports having these strange experiences. And so my thought is, well, if they're having strange experiences and even so-called, if I can use this term, normal people report sometimes hearing things or seeing things, even just once or twice, that we could even say, okay, that's an auditory or a visual hallucination. Well, I think we need to approach this with a very balanced view and not a knee-jerk reaction that obviously, oh, this person's got to be a little mentally ill. The other thing too is that our media and our culture is, definitely influence us. And you guys in particular have seen with your work more openness to what you guys are doing. And so, we have cable television that shows all these programs about the paranormal and the strange. Some of them sincere, some of them far from sincere. And so, when the client is coming in, they may already, due to the media, have a perspective that what's happened to me may be paranormal. And I think rather than just jump to the reaction, it is or it isn't, maybe just allowing the client to express what's going on with them without any judgment and just seeing whatever direction to take that would benefit the client. I read a study out of England. I wish I could remember the authors, but it's a fairly recent study that they found that people who reported having paranormal experiences, and by that they meant hauntings or intense psychic phenomena, that if they were able to talk to a mental health care professional who was showed empathy and didn't judge them and just gave them a place to talk about it, most of them found that the events, it ceased bothering them. And what's really fascinating to me is their mood improved, their outlook on life. They found that there was they felt more connected to the natural world, more connected to others. And it was seen as a positive experience, where unfortunately, a lot of us, it's like, OK, there's obviously something wrong with their brain, or if you want to go deep into the psychodynamic world of somebody seeing something, maybe it's a repression from an earlier trauma. And that could be true, but it could also be the brain's just doing that and doesn't have to be, something pathological or possibly, maybe things outside the realm of what we can measure. So I think maybe taking a wait and see perspective not only helps the field grow, but I think it also honors the client's experience.
I'm curious then, what are your thoughts on the fact that these things are not supernatural in the most popularized sense of the word? What if it's just mere projections you know, which is still supernatural, but it's not, you know, it's not ghosts and demons. It is projections of the inner workings of our mind. It's the projections of those things we want, desire, or fear most. And that it is, you know, within ourselves, we have that ability, like telepathy. Mm-hmm. I almost said telepathy, which is totally not a word, but with telepathy, being able to connect with you. Psychologically, you were able to pick up on your patient's father and the information. Does that mean he was there giving you the message, or were you tapped into her stream of consciousness and you unlocked one of the levels in her brain that allowed you to access a memory?
Right. Yeah, I tend to, and again, I'm more, try to look for the most logical, rational explanation, but I tend to think there's a possibility for just that. I remember a Nandor Fodor, who was a follower of Freud, who made quite a name for himself investigating poltergeists back in the 30s and 40s. He saw that most poltergeist activity he put right in the realm of the unconscious mind projecting information out into the environment, which caused physical shifts. So it was more, I don't know if they had this term then, but it was more of a psychokinesis rather than a disembodied entity. He kind of continued to hold that perspective. You know, a lot of the early it's really fascinating. I found a lot of the early forerunners of psychology, the strange, the paranormal, the parapsychological, the fingerprints are all over the early days of and creations of psychology. And a lot of these people dealt with these kind of things and, you know, the exploration of hypnotic phenomena and disassociation and all of those for the early developers, they generally looked for a materialistic explanation, but yet they viewed a lot of this coming from the unconscious mind, or, you know, we call it sometimes the subconscious. So unresolved things, uncomfortable things, or whatever, will get projected into the environment, which to me, I just see that's kind of paranormal. They say, well, it's not paranormal, it's the unconscious. Well, you can't really touch the unconscious, you know?
That's right.
So it's just as weird to me as saying, you know, somebody's father is in the room with me. And I think the struggle in those early days to distance from non-materialistic explanations was to kind of establish and be accepted as a science. But the first two or three international congresses of psychology, half the presenters were members of the Society for Psychical Research. I mean, it's really amazing. The best qualitative research was made better due to the influence of psychical researchers. So I don't know. I think that, yes, our mind can project and do all these kind of things, and I tend to lean that direction. But at the same time, if you can never know what you don't know. Let's kind of put it that way.
I like that. I like that. Let's do this. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to get into some of the strange situations, some of the other weird manifestations and stories that you cover in the book. So stay tuned. We've got more coming your way. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. This is Beyond the Darkness.
As always, a big thank you for listening to our show. We'd like to ask you a small but very important favor, and it'll only take a few minutes. And if you're one of the first people to do it, Podcast One will make it worth your time. Literally. We need you to complete a short survey because the information you give us can help make things better for the show and you as a listener. Just go to podcastone.com/survey and everything will be right there for you. That's podcastone.com/survey. The first 250 people who complete that survey will get a $10 gift card to amazon.com. And two grand prize winners will be selected at random to get a $100 Amazon gift card. Now, how about that? Free money. It's a win-win. Our shows are supported by advertisers, so filling this out will really, really help us cater to the needs of you as a listener. So please go to podcastone.com/survey. Answer some questions and potentially make some money along the way. Thank you for being a dedicated listener. Dave and I here at Beyond the Darkness appreciate you.
Beyond the Darkness.
We're back. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave. That's Tim. We probably won't be talking to you folks again until next week after Halloween, but we just wanted to spend a second and wish you Happy Halloween, everyone. Okay, maybe I'm the only one that wanted to wish you Happy Halloween, but I still do, for both Tim and I.
I do. I had my mouth full of fun-sized Milky Way bars. That's all.
Oh, it's not Halloween yet, Tim. You're not supposed to eat the candy at this point.
I've already had 4 bags, Dave.
That's, Tim, you're a diabetic. That's not a good plan.
I took extra insulin, Dave.
You know what you need?
What's that?
Well, insulin's not the answer, Tim. You should just stay away from the sugars. It'll help you. Know what it sounds like you need is a good psychotherapist. If only we knew one. Oh, yeah. We do.
Oh.
Dr. Paul Leslie is here. His book, Shadows in the Session, The Presence of the Anomalous in Psychotherapy. Doc, you got to get in the head of Tim Dennis and break this sugar habit of his. 4 bags of Milky Way minis.
Yeah, well, I don't take hopeless cases. So.
All right. Let's dive into some of the stories and cases that you cover. And, I'm curious, have any of the psychotherapists or psychoanalysts, I'm not quite sure what their proper title is, have any of them ever been truly terrified by the type of experience that they witnessed?
Well, there's most of them, I think it's one of those things where you go through the, did I just see what I thought I saw? And did I just feel what I think? It's like, this can't possibly be happening to me. It's kind of, in some ways, you hear about people who witness or go through a traumatic event. It's that moment as it's starting, what's happening? I don't know what's going on. And a lot of times by the time they finally have a recognition, the event has passed. There's the predominant emotion that I've gotten in the stories I've received from other therapists was that it comes down to 2 emotions, confusion and disorientation. Only one of them later said that they got really wigged out, and it was this person who was having this session with a woman where she was talking about her mother and how her mother had always been there for her, and the mother had passed away a year or two earlier. And then as she's talking about the mother, the therapist happens to see what looks like, as they put it, some kind of dark mass materialize behind the client. And it almost looked like it's a figure with putting its arms on the shoulders of the client who was sitting in a chair. But because it was so strange and out of the ordinary, it took a whole little bit of time to where the therapist is going, am I seeing what I'm seeing? And so kind of shaking off, is it the lighting? It wasn't so overt that, you know, they would jump up, there's a person behind you. But a minute later, it was still there and then finally disappeared. And so they, you know, wonder and get disoriented and confused. And then after the fact, they're like, did I see what I thought I saw? And then the discomfort and fear may kick in, but it's usually the shock and surprise. We naturally, our brains naturally seek to create meaning. If we see something we don't understand, our brains look for a reason to, okay, well, this is why this is happening. And if it's something that's so far out of our realm of experience, we've never experienced something like that, it kind of throws our brain.
Yeah, I'm sure it certainly does. What do you make of these things when you see a large shadowy figure kind of either emit from a person or appear behind them? What does that mean to you as a therapist? And what do you think that it represents?
Well, for me, I mean, my first knee-jerk response would be that, okay, well, you know, was the you go through the checklist. Was the therapist working too hard, too tired? What's the environmental factors? You know, I believe in, like Sherlock Holmes, you take all the factors that are the logical and obvious, and then once that's all gone, then you can make a better analytical, meaning to what's happening. But if all of those and many of these people I talked to were very direct with me about, listen, I was 100% aware. I wasn't I don't feel I was hallucinating. I certainly hadn't been drinking or doing any kind of drugs. I've never had this happen. I've met with clients at this particular time in this room, you know, for years, and I've never seen this. There's no issues with the air conditioner, go on, et cetera, et cetera. So going back to maybe what we discussed earlier, maybe it was a projection of the client seeking that connection with the mother. And then somehow, again, I have no proof, but, you know, if you've gotten rid of all the possibilities, that maybe that and therapist was tapping into that, and maybe the therapist's mind was creating some way to comfort the client, and so they kind of psychologically projected this form or whatever. But because they were they're unaware, because it's coming from an unconscious mind, it seems like it's apart from themselves. So I mean, you can go down the rabbit hole, and that's what's fascinating to me. Is for me, it's always A plus B equals C, and I'm finding out that, you know, you can go in so many directions when you just don't have, you know, all the information.
The supernatural beings and creatures, has there ever been anything considered to be angelic that the psychotherapists witness at these moments?
Most of the time, it's usually, again, just on the people I've talked to, seems to be a tie-in to parental or grandparents or something like that. So it hasn't been seen as anything demonic, if I can use that term, or angelic. It's generally a positive thing for the client, or possibly that's related to the client. I have not, and I may get, you know, an email tomorrow with someone going, oh, here's my story, and oh my gosh, you wouldn't believe this, and, you know, there's six horned demons coming out. I mean, I don't know, you know, but overall, I wouldn't say that it was either, you know, creating the distinction of demonic or angelic. It tends to be more a familiar presence or energy or something like that for the client.
What are some of the more stunning stories that you uncovered in revealing this book and from these different therapists around? And I'm also curious, do the experiencers are they witnessing it as well as the psychotherapist, or is it usually just what the psychotherapist is uncovering?
It's kind of interesting. The people that talk to me, it tends to be the therapist that talked to me. It tends to be they try to not say anything because the client isn't noticing it or doesn't have the same experience. So a lot of that maybe the client is having an experience, but they're keeping their mouth closed because, I mean, well, let's be quite blunt. I am a big proponent, believer in psychotherapy. You know, I think we've got more than 40 years of peer-reviewed research that certainly shows that we're helpful to people who seek it. And I'm president of the psychotherapy fan club. At the same time, if I started having some really weird things and I'm sitting there with a therapist, I might not say anything. Because if I'm trying to figure out what's going on and I start blurting out, there's a dark figure behind you that you might not see. You know, that notebook might get scribbled on some things that might not really reflect what's happening to me, because we all have a frame of reference. So if the therapist's frame of reference is anyone who reports that's automatically, crazy. I might keep that to myself. So I understand that from the client perspective. Therapists tend to keep it quiet because they don't want to upset the client. And maybe they're still, as I say, grappling with that. Other interesting things that I heard, one thing surprised me was a One of the therapists I talked to was working with a couple one time, and the couple seemed to be having normal couple issues, but they reached a point where nothing was getting better. The wife in the relationship just couldn't seem to, no matter what they did, they were getting stuck and couldn't move forward. And then one day in the session, out of the blue, the therapist heard loud and clear as if someone was yelling right beside them to ask about the woman's aunt. And so she thought someone was yelling, you know, down the hall or something. And she said, well, I'm the only one in the office. So she excused herself to make sure someone hadn't just walked into the office and couldn't find anybody. The door, she locks the door when she's working with a client, and came back and someone didn't know what was happening. So a minute later, it happened again. Ask about the aunt. And so finally, after being rattled, and she even asked, have you heard anything? And then the client said, no, we didn't hear anything. She finally asked about the aunt. And all of a sudden, the wife just let loose a torrential downpour of emotion coming out. Apparently, the aunt was the one that she really was her mother figure. And she lost her aunt about a year and a half ago. And she had never really accepted that her death, and there's a lot of grief, and it was the grief that was getting in the way of the relationship moving forward. So without that bit of information, which, you know, the therapist would not, and even the husband was surprised that that had anything to do with it, that was a big breakthrough. And so this therapist told me, to this day, I've never heard anything like this before. It's like someone sitting there and saying really loud. And for a long time, she said, I almost didn't want to work with these people anymore because I'm not used to that. So right there, just in that, that could be the intuition, that could be that grid of information. But here's something that if the therapist hadn't taken, you know, heed of that, you know, this couple might not have been able to move forward, and this woman might not have been able to adequately deal with her own grief. So I think having that openness to at least investigating, you know, what's happening without instantly dismissing it or thinking you're crazy, I think is so important.
No doubt. You know, what's interesting to me is that she's hearing the screaming, you know, ask the aunt. Like, that wouldn't be a weird thing to hear come from anybody anyway. Who, even if it was another employee or another therapist or somebody else in the building, why would they just suddenly feel the urge to yell, ask about the aunt?
Right, exactly. Right?
That's so bizarre that they're like, what? Why? Mm-hmm. Why am I getting this advice? That's just a weird aspect of the story.
Yeah, no doubt.
Now, when it comes to having moments, and I'm curious what your thoughts are on this. We have encountered people who will see raised scratches on their arms or stomachs, things that happen, and sometimes right in front of our eyes.
Right.
I watched this occur. I was in a place in Metuchen, New Jersey, and I was working with a medium. And as we were talking about, all of a sudden you could see what looked like a braided rope burn around her neck.
Mm-hmm.
That just completely boggled my mind that I was watching that kind of occur. What do you make of that? Is there a psychological connection that could cause those type of phenomena to happen?
Yeah, I think it's tied to what we would call dissociative trance disorder, which essentially means as if someone gets their feels like their body's being taken over. Or, they feel like they're doing things out of their control. I was actually having a conversation one time with a researcher who had done some work in Haiti, and he had seen these people go into these strange trances where they're supposed to be possessed by a certain voodoo deity. And just watching their voice change, their face change, things with their physicality moving ways that they normally couldn't. And I was kind of thinking that that's, you know, not unlike you hear. And now I'm in the South, so there's many churches where on a Sunday people will go to church and feel as if the Holy Spirit takes them over. And they go into these kind of chanting, foaming at the mouth things. But then as soon as the service is over, you know, that's over. But in extreme situations like you're saying around the neck, or you know, in these exorcism cases where you know the body will react certain ways. And again, this is my left brain here, but I just think our mind, if our mind can create this placebo effect, which I think needs a lot more research, then if it can change the way we think we're getting a certain medication when we're not getting it, I don't see any reason why skin, the flow of blood to around the neck, you know, when someone's in a certain emotional state where they are either tapping into or imagining the feelings of being choked or that. So I just think the power of the human mind, and maybe that's what keeps me interested in psychology, I don't think we've even remotely been able to access it.
I've, you know, talking to people involved in the paranormal field for years, Richard Crowe, who was a paranormal investigator and researcher out of Illinois, talked about this person's dependence on a Ouija board. Mm-hmm. And how when you would take the Ouija board away from them, they would have physical manifestations appear on their body of markings and things. And he believed it was nothing more than psychological.
Mm-hmm.
I just had a hard time. How do you start writing words on your stomach, you know, that start to show up and rise in front of your eyes? And he was a firm believer in the paranormal, but he just believed this was more of a mental situation. Are we really that far behind the curve of understanding just what kind of capabilities we're truly capable of?
I absolutely think so. I think particularly in my field, we have so focused on a linear medical model way of explaining phenomena that we forget that, you know, people are so complex, and to approach things systemically to where it's not always A will lead to B. The fact that just using that case you said, let's just assume hypothetically that it is psychological. Well, you know, we could say, oh, it's just the mind doing that. Or is it the mind and who's taking the board away? Or is it certain key developmental things that happened related to this board? I mean, we can go on and on. And I think it's we limit our ability to understand these things and to really grasp what our mind's capable of, I think, due to looking at it can only be physical. When we say this can only be a physical, yes, if we're creating physical reactions in our body, it's physical. But you know, Descartes years ago back, I think 1700s, I can't remember how far back, talked about how the mind and the body were two separate things. And all that's been shown to us over and over again is the brain may create the mind, but the mind can also affect the brain. It's this incredible cybernetic loop that happens. So when the brain's able to change itself, I don't know why our mind couldn't affect other things about our body.
All right. I know time is fleeting, but what are some of the other strange stories that you cover in the book from different therapists?
Yeah, one I found kind of fascinating is that, and this would be similar to what you hear with the parent who feels like, you know, wakes up one night and says, oh, my gosh, my child is in trouble. And they find out their adult child was in a car wreck. I had one therapist who told me he had worked with this client, and they'd worked together for about 6 to 7 months, I think. And then, you know, the session ended. The goals of treatment had been met. And one day out of the blue, months later, the therapist went to the little kitchen area to get some coffee. And all of a sudden in her mind saw this image of this particular client who she hadn't seen in months, just distraught, just horribly distraught, upset. And she had this feeling that something terrible had happened. So like, again, what do? We get disoriented, we get confused. And so she kind of pushed it away, but yet it was such an intense, I would say it's a visual hallucination, but you know, you say, oh, it's just a feeling. But the way she was describing it, she really saw, like she was watching a movie that, you know, she was a part of this event. So it kept nagging at her. And I think if I remember correctly, the next day, either the therapist just decided to go ahead and call, or that client called to make an appointment. Found out that the client had just lost a family member, and something else bad had happened, and they were just overwhelmed with this intense form of grief, and just, I mean, we felt like they were at their last hanging on by a thread, you know, and yet this therapist was able to pick just out of the blue, not even thinking about this person, get this image of them and be so moved to kind of carry that around and to be emotionally and to some degree physically affected by it.
When it comes to the concept of ghosts, mm-hmm. where do most of you stand on that? Do you believe that we do transcend our physical form and that something spiritual remains?
Well, I will avoid answering that for my field, but I think my field, the field of psychology, will pretty much say that, you know, ghosts don't exist. They are, you know, when we die, because if our brain, if we're all material, the brain is a material that stops working, so our consciousness ends. However, many parapsychologists, and I'm talking legitimate psychologists who study this, admit something is happening, but they are not so quick to say that it's a ghost or a spirit, but yet something is happening. Now, here comes the bigger question of consciousness. Can consciousness survive after death? And if we believe that that is possible, that consciousness is non-local, that it's not always just in our brain, that opens some intriguing, you know, what ifs. Well, if it is non-local, well, why would it? And how much of the personality? But then there's a step further, that if somebody's just seeing a certain thing over and over, like, oh, this old house, 300 years old, you always see this particular farmer walking around at night, and, you know, people have seen it for 200 years, is that really consciousness, or is that something, you know, you get into the parallel multiverse or whatever, playing a tape, you know, I think what they call it, stone tape, kind of thing.
Very right.
Yeah. So
things, sure.
Yeah. So it's hard to say. For my personal opinion, I'm thinking as a scientist, I don't have the answer. I think in my gut, I think something's going on, but I don't know if it's always just a knee jerk reaction that it's got to be a spirit. But at the same time, if we do find that the world is indeed more mysterious than we think, you know, all bets are off.
Was there ever any edict in kind of the psychoanalyst handbook in dealing with the spiritual nature of life and our fears of death and ghosts and things along that nature? Or has it always been to just kind of dismiss it as mourning issues, grief issues, so on and so forth?
Well, the early days of Freud, even though he was absolutely fascinated in telepathy and did secret experiments with his daughter and Sandor Ferenczi, who was the head of the psychoanalysis organization in Hungary, he kept it all hidden. But he didn't really believe in spirits and things like that, at least publicly. Carl Jung, who a lot of people know about, he was very open to those kind of things and those possibilities. And there's been a handful of, and I am detailing the book, certain people in the last, since the time of Freud, the last 40, 50, 60 years, who did come up and say something's going on, whether it's ESP, whether it's poltergeist, where it's this, but they pretty much unanimously or droned out of their field or maligned or ridiculed. So I would say today in the field of psychoanalysis, even though I'm not a psychoanalyst, it's still, I think there may be some openness privately, but publicly there's not. And just in the general field of psychotherapy, I don't think that most people in the field will publicly say, yes, I believe there's a spirit world or a supernatural realm. And that's fine. But I think if we take such a hard line, as in, you know, we may not believe it, but we forget, you know, our belief is just our belief, and we have to honor our clients' belief sometimes if we want to be able to help them, particularly if one of the reasons they may be having emotional issues is due to strange phenomena And if they're not in a safe place to tell the therapist about that, I mean, we're not acting as what I think we're supposed to be, which are healers. So, it may change, but I think we're still kind of the gag rule is still in order there.
When people are having experiences with the supernatural and the paranormal and they're feeling despondent, and we have listeners across the world, even though they tune into the show and they watch all the shows, they still feel as though maybe their grasp on reality is not there. Yeah. They question their mental state or stability, and it can bring on insane waves of depression. What advice do you have for people that believe that they are dealing with true supernatural occurrences and feel isolated by it?
Yeah. Well, the first thing obviously is to, I think, going back to ruling out everything. And if some of these paranormal TV shows, I mean, Present Company excluded, Dave, I will say, that they just automatically, at least the way the show's set up, they automatically assume every creak you hear in a 300-year-old house has to be a spirit. But a good, if you are seeking help with that, finding somebody who is, and I say someone who's not a believer, to, if they're experiencing all kinds of paranormal things in their home, rule out that. If someone is having visions and psychic phenomena, unfortunately, you have to be kind of careful who you talk to. So I would say if you're thinking about seeking some help on how to deal with things that you really do truly feel after a lot of good debunking and all that still is happening, make sure you interview the person before and say it's a very special, and we always hear it's a special case, but that is a special case. And if I talk to you about this, are you automatically going to label me as someone who's having a mental health problem, even though I am fine in every area? You know, when you have a disorder, a psychological disorder, I tell all my college students, the person to have a disorder, they have to have significant distress, significant dysfunction in their life, and significant deviance from their norm. So if someone's having that due to what they perceive as a spiritual or a paranormal issue, and they have ruled out all physical other psychological factors, that person still needs help. And maybe all they need is just somebody to sit with who doesn't say, "I think you're nuts," and just listens and supports what they're doing. And I think they're out there. I really do, Dave. And my research shows they're out there, but they may have to be prodded a little bit and say, you know, "I know you're a therapist, but are you automatically going to label me?" I have a case I know of people close to me who one of the people were having some paranormal phenomena in their home, and they wanted to put this person on heavy dose medication for no other instances except in the home. So they weren't having this any other place, and it wasn't causing dysfunction in their lives. So we got to quit that knee-jerk reaction and maybe step back and say, well, what else is going on? I mean, if it is a projection of the mind, maybe we need to work with the family. Maybe there's some family issues. But I think just vetting who you talk to is probably a good thing anyway, even if it's not paranormal. You know, talk to the person if you're seeking help from to know that you're a good fit and that you won't be labeled unnecessarily.
That's some great advice, and I hope our listeners can take from that and you know, realize they're not alone, and that it's not a sign of insanity. It may be a sign of other underlying issues, but there is a safe zone in order to talk about these type of things. When you talk about this, the therapists having this type of activity, how often, you know, do you see that it's kind of reversed where the patient starts picking up on the doctor?
I think when you're in any type of intense relationship, whether it's with therapeutic relationship, a business or personal relationship, we intuitively know something's going on and with how another person is. But there's multiple cases I remember the late psychoanalyst Robert Stroller wrote about in a paper which he ended up not publishing. It was only published after his death due to his fear of his career being ruined, where he would talk about his patients who would come in. He'd have something happen to him, and then they would come in with a dream they had that would mirror almost exactly what he was going through. For example, he was building a new house, and he went to the work site one day and found that someone had vandalized what was going to be the bathroom. They'd broken in and done that. Well, the patient the next day or two came in and said, I had this strange dream that I was walking around a website, and I saw this bathroom, and there was all this scribbling spray paint all over this bathroom, and it just seemed very significant. And of course, Stroller probably didn't tell his patient, you know, that's my bathroom, you know. So I think it can go both ways here. This is, and I use the term systemic and circular. And I think that's what happens, particularly when we're in a close relationship with someone. So certainly they can pick up all kinds of things.
What do you hope people get from this book and can take away from it?
For the psychotherapist, because I wrote it for the public, but also for psychotherapists. For psychotherapists, I hope it just starts a dialogue. Because I will tell you truthfully, Dave, if they can come out, whoever the powers that be are they, can come out and say, well, this is why this happened to you with your client, and it's strictly physical and, you know, nothing to worry about, I am totally fine with that. If they disprove all paranormal phenomena, I am totally fine with that. But we're a long way from really doing that, I think. And I think the psychotherapist, if they read that, they'll come away maybe saying, you know, it's okay if this happens to you, you're not alone. And maybe open your mind a little bit to what your clients are going through. And then for people who aren't the therapists who are reading it, to know that there are therapists out there who've had experiences, and even those who haven't, who are open to maybe having that discussion. You know, research is showing that odd ideas, odd beliefs, paranormal, spiritual ideas. Most of our clients actually want to talk about these kind of things. And it may be their religious faith and all that. If the research is showing clients want to talk about that, we don't need to be shutting them down. We need to be hearing their stories. Even if we don't believe why it's happening, it is very real to them. And the only way I have found over my years of practice to help someone is to enter their world. And if I am so entrenched in my own world and just want to tell them that they're wrong and act as the authority figure, number one, it's ineffective. And number two, it's just not honoring the individual. And I think we really need to let people know that there are people out there that, even if down deep we may say, I don't really think that's a ghost, or I don't really think you're psychic, or maybe it's because of this, that it's okay, that there's nothing wrong with you in many of these cases.
Very cool. Thank you so much, Dr. Leslie. It's been a pleasure speaking with you today. Thank you for coming on and sharing the insights in your new book. And we have a link up for that book. If you check on today's program, you'll see the link there. Make sure to order it. And then do us a favor. When you get books like this, make sure you go rate and review them so that they get pushed up higher in the ratings and people can find this book more easily when they're looking for fascinating reads. So thank you again, Dr. Leslie. It's been a pleasure.
It's always great talking to you guys. Thanks for all you do.
Thank you very much. And hey, while you're at it, do us a favor. Go over to iTunes, rate and review the program. Why not give us 5 stars? Because damn it, it's the right thing to do. Leave a nice little blurb if you get the chance. If you don't, just give us the 5 stars. That'll help push us up through the iTunes list as well and expose us to even more listeners worldwide. And we'd love your help in doing that. Remember, you helping us keeps us on the air even longer. And with that said, we'll be back True Crime Tuesday, another brand new episode. Our good friend Mark Anthony back. We've got a fascinating case that's supernatural and true crime this Tuesday. And if you're not already subscribed, then Tim and I will ask you right now, please subscribe. If you've been on the fence, you've been thinking about it, considering it, this is the great time to go ahead and subscribe. It'll give you access to not only all of our new episodes that come out once a week, but it gives you access to all of our past archives. What is it, Tim, over 180 episodes now?
No. We're at right around 135.
That's what I said, 135 episodes, all available for you That's each episode is 90 minutes to 2 hours long. So that comes, if my math is right, Tim, to close to 8,000 hours of entertainment.
Sure, right around that, yeah.
Yeah, right. Roughly. I might, you know, give or take 1,000 or eight hours. But the shows are up and available and gives you access to all of the past archives and all of the new archives. You can get information by going to darknessradio.com and click on our True Crime Tuesday link. Subscribe, $5 a month. That's all we're asking from you. $1.25 for each new episode. And that new episode opens up the past episodes to you as well. So really, that $5 gives you immeasurable amount of entertainment value. And if you love true crime as much as we do, and you love dumb crimes and stupid criminals, then you need to subscribe to True Crime Tuesday. Stop pussyfooting around. Get on the stick. Go subscribe right now. Support your buddies, because by supporting True Crime Tuesday, that helps keep this show on the air as well. All right, that's it for this week. We'll be back True Crime Tuesday, and we'll be back next weekend with even more strange tales of the supernatural. And don't forget, oh, by the way, next weekend we're going to talk Bigfoot, Tim. We've got some really interesting audio to talk about next Sunday.
Oh, cool.
Saturday, Parashare and Supernatural News. So that's what's on tap for Beyond the Darkness. And remember, you can listen to me 5 nights a week, Monday through Friday on Midnight in the Desert, the best in anomalous talk radio. Weekends with the best in paranormal talk radio. And Tuesdays, the best in true crime talk radio. And then don't forget every Thursday, the best in paranormal TV programming, The Holzer Files on the Travel Channel. That's a whole lot of promotion, but it's a whole lot of entertainment. I hope you guys will go check it out for yourselves. Take a look, enjoy, and thank you all for supporting us. Happy Halloween, everybody.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.